Countrywide on ABC Radio.
Support businesses are going to go to the wall just like dairy farmers will.
We've seen the whole agricultural community come out.
Once people leave communities, they generally don't return.
Countrywide.
Don't worry about me. Go and speak to your farmers.
We're already losing businesses.
Get out there and speak to your farmers with your gumboots on.
Countrywide, the politics of food and farming on ABC Radio.
G'day and welcome to Countrywide. Jess Davis with you this week. On today's show, a push to end the ban on gun silencers for recreational shooters in Victoria.
As an ex-policeman, I don't want criminals having these. Sadly, they've already got them. We're keeping them away from the good people on the pretense of keeping them away from the bad people.
But first, the National Australia Bank has bowed to pressure from the public, customers and government to improve its lending practices in the agribusiness sector. The bank will stop charging drought-affected farmers penalty interest rates for missed repayments, despite telling the Royal Commission just a few weeks ago that the practice met community expectations. Lauren Pezzett spoke to CEO Andrew Thorburn.
For agri clients who are in drought-affected areas in the country, that we will no longer charge a default interest rate, so that if they get into arrears, they're already going through difficult times. We're not going to increase that interest rate further. Obviously, they're going through financial stress and emotional stress, so we're going to stop that. And I think that's another leadership position we can take.
NAB will also offer their agri customers the ability to offset their farm management deposit against their agricultural lending, a move that Agriculture Minister David Littleproud had been calling for. Mr Thorburn announced his bank's policy changes after visiting the Riverina to meet face-to-face with agribusiness clients.
And is this effectively an apology tour, given the way that the banks have treated the farmers so poorly, as we've heard in the Royal Commission?
Well, we have been banking Australian farmers for 160 years, and I think with the one-third market share today and the feedback we get about our agri-bankers, and we've got 500 agri-bankers around Australia. I've met one of them today, Mick, does a wonderful job. And we've just taken another 50 graduates, agri-graduates. So I think we do a lot of things right. But clearly, with a business our size and some of the things, as you say, coming out of the Royal Commission, we need to reflect on that and we need to change and learn. So we want to get better and we want to own up to issues and we want to make it better for clients. And I think this is part of it.
Will you be doing anything to help farmers out retrospectively who have already been through a lot?
Well, on the offset accounts, we'll do that. We'll write to our clients now, and we'll start as soon as they nominate the account. We will start to get that underway for them. And on default interest rates, look, one of the challenges was let's do something that's immediate and forward-looking. So, you know, we'll continue to review this, but in relation to the default interest rates, that will be from now for today for those clients who are affected.
And do you see the farming sector as a business opportunity for the NAB, given that home loans in the cities look like they're starting to drop off?
Oh, look, farming and agri clients has been a really important part of our whole business for 160 years. And it's just a business that's continued to grow and expand. It's a very big export earner for Australia. We should be proud of it. And when you meet many of our farming clients, you know, they are people and businesses that are bold and that we keep backing, and you know, they've got very successful businesses, and we're very pleased to be part of it. At the same time, though, because we're a broad bank, business loans and corporate loans and also home loans are really important. So it's not about one's more important than the other. They're all important, but I certainly think with our heritage and market position, agri, rural, regional Australia is really important to us.
Is this really just getting on the front foot for what you think you'll be forced to do anyway as an outcome of the Royal Commission?
Look, we have to manage our business for the long term. We've always done that, and I think we must do that in the future. And there's no doubt the Royal Commission's providing some pretty sad, unfortunate cases that we have to take accountability for. It is a Royal Commission into misconduct, so we're going to unfortunately see that. But also, when we step back from it, there's a lot of our almost all of our bankers and our clients we're doing really good things for that we can be very proud of. Clients that I visited today that speak highly of their banker and what the bank has done. So, yes, we have to own these issues and make change from them. There's no doubt about that. But also, we need to keep it in perspective that many of the things we're doing and our staff are doing are wonderful things to help clients.
That was CEO of NAB, Andrew Thorburn, speaking with Lauren Pezzett. The Shooters, Fishers and Farmers Party has taken its push to end the ban on gun silencers for recreational shooters to Victoria's Parliament. Gun control groups say it's part of a national trend, with other states and territories also under pressure from the gun lobby to weaken laws governing silencers. But as Rachel Carbonell reports, it isn't just gun control groups opposing the bill. Some farmers are also speaking out against it.
In the city, gunshot noise is always alarming. But in the countryside, it's pretty common. Shooters can often be heard firing at rabbits, wild dogs, pigs, foxes, kangaroos, or even stock that needs to be put down. Victorian Shooters, Fishers and Farmers Party MP Jeff Borman is introducing a private members' bill which would make it legal for all licensed shooters to use silencers or suppressors. He says it would protect shooters' hearing.
I've got a lot of hearing damage to one of my ears when someone fired a gun next to it years ago that would have been, or most likely, prevented with a suppressor.
And he says silencers are helpful for hunters.
If you shoot at one deer, the noise from a suitable firearm is quite astronomical. And that one deer is basically what you get, scares all the other ones away. With a moderator, it'll take it down from something that's an extremely loud noise to something that is loud, but won't travel as far. So you're more likely to get more deer.
Gun silencers are strictly controlled everywhere in Australia. Usually only specialists, such as professional contract shooters or veterinarians, are allowed to use them. Gun control advocates say the only thing worse than hearing gunshots is not hearing when a gun is fired. Jeff Borman says it's a misconception that suppressors silence guns.
The noise it makes is still quite clearly a gunshot. The best supersonic cartridge that gets suppressed still sounds like a normal .22 rimfire that is unsuppressed, which is still quite loud and still quite clearly a gunshot.
But silencers don't only muffle the sound of a firearm, they can disguise the direction of the shots fired. Farmer Leonard Valance is head of the Victorian Farmers Federation Livestock Group and a licensed gun user. He says while most shooters do the right thing, illegal shooting on country properties is a problem.
They shoot stuff that they shouldn't shoot, they leave gates open, they leave rubbish around the property. They are a safety hazard to the farmer, the livestock and the wider community.
And he doesn't want gun silencers made more widely available.
If you were a landowner and you had an illegal shooter on your property, it would be very difficult to work out where they actually were located.
Farmers are divided on the issue, but Leonard Valance thinks the majority of farmers support the current regulations.
In the last 12 months, two of my neighbours have had their gun safes broken into on their properties, and they were locked away properly, bolted down and secured, and they were still had their firearms stolen out of their gun safes. My concern would be that if the firearms were stolen with silencers fitted to them, that then they could then enter into the illegal crime market, and that would be a problem for everyone.
Jeff Borman disagrees.
As an ex-policeman, I don't want criminals having these. Sadly, they've already got them. We're keeping them away from the good people on the pretense of keeping them away from the bad people.
The bill follows a parliamentary e-petition which attracted almost 6,000 signatures. The Sporting Shooters Association and the Australian Deer Association also support the bill. However, the Victorian Labor Government and Victoria Police both say they support the current regulatory approach to silencers, and the state opposition says it will oppose the bill. But Gun Control Australia says it's part of a wider national trend. Director Samantha Lee says the Tasmanian government has flagged changes to silencer laws, while New South Wales and the ACT have already made changes.
One state is allowed to deplete its laws, and there are successes for the gun lobby in a particular state. Other states will follow.
Ms. Lee says it's a trend that threatens to further undermine Australia's gun control laws.
Rachel Carbonell reporting. Hospital data from as far back as the 1930s has confirmed the link between animals and humans in the spread of antibiotic resistance. While in Australia the problem is more likely to be an issue of people interacting with their pets, in other countries it's intensive agriculture that's to blame. I spoke to Associate Professor Stephen Tong from the University of Melbourne's Infectious Diseases Unit, who contributed to the international study which looked at samples of the common bacteria golden staph.
We know across a lot of different studies that antibiotics used in livestock management can lead to the emergence of resistance in the bacteria that infect those livestock. This is a specific example with golden staph, where in chickens, cows and pigs, there have been instances where the use of antibiotics has generated resistance, and these clones can then spread back into the human population.
Can you explain how that works for someone who doesn't understand infections?
Sure. So it's all about selective pressure, so evolution. If you provide a whole bunch of antibiotics to animals or humans and they have bacteria on them, the ones which survive will be those that are resistant to those antibiotics. So if a cow has golden staph and it's given a whole bunch of antibiotics, then the golden staph that survives will be those that are resistant to those antibiotics. So the use of overuse of antibiotics will ultimately drive antibiotic resistance.
Do humans then become antibiotic resistant through eating the meat or through transference of infections from animal to human?
So in this paper demonstrates that it goes both ways. There's both transmission from humans to animals and then also back from animals to humans. And with Staph aureus, so this germ in particular, it's more a skin-to-skin pathogen, so it's mainly by contact, not so much by eating.
So we shouldn't be worried about eating the meat itself. It's more about the evolution of those animals that were eating.
That's correct. So an example would be in the Netherlands, there were pig farms where there were lots of these infections in the pigs, and it was the farmers and the farmers' families that tended to get these infections.
So this study, you mentioned the Netherlands, did they look at other places around the world?
So over 800 Staph aureus isolates collected across the five continents, I think it was 50 countries or so, so it was a very big data set, and looking for kind of, I guess, global patterns of this. So I've given examples in the Netherlands, but there certainly were other countries involved, and a lot of these were kind of multiple country spread of these resistant pathogens. But it's probably the largest study of this kind for golden staph that's been done so far. So people have looked into specific, I guess, types of golden staph, so the ones in pigs or the ones in cows. This one brings all those different animal groups and human isolates together. The isolates that were involved in the study actually spanned from 1930 to 2014, so a very long period. A lot of places have big isolate collections, and so you can actually delve back into those and go back to, say, ones from the 1930s and say, hey, what did those bacteria look like? And nowadays with DNA sequencing technology, we can go back to those isolates, sequence the DNA from those, which has remained stable over that time, and compare it to the DNA sequence of isolates from today.
Australia's chief vet, Dr. Mark Shipp, believes both farm animals and household pets play a significant role in the spread of antibiotic resistance.
In terms of on-farm biosecurity, it's important that humans don't infect the animals. And we've seen that on a number of occasions where influenzas have passed from humans to the animals that they're caring for. And likewise, in the home setting, we've seen it with humans passing resistant bacterial infections onto their pets, and then their pets picking up that infection and over time passing it back to the humans because they're sharing a very close environment with food and sleeping arrangements and living arrangements, because we spend such close shared environment with our pets and companion animals. They really are part of the family, and that family includes shared pathogens and bacterial infections.
He says Australia needs to focus on how antibiotics are prescribed for people.
Of all of the countries that have been tested, Australia ranks as one of the lowest users of antibiotics in livestock production, but one of the highest in terms of human health. So we over-prescribe in the human sector and are one of the lowest users in the livestock and animal agriculture sector.
That was Australia's Chief Veterinary Officer, Dr. Mark Shipp.
You're listening to Countrywide, across Australia and around the world on ABC Radio.
Jess Davis bringing you Countrywide this week. Seafood producers in Tasmania are raising concerns about the use of seismic marine testing by oil and gas companies. It's a process where hundreds of sonic blasts measure the geology of the seabed in the hopes of finding oil or gas deposits. Fishermen are raising the alarm about the damage they believe the practice has on sea life. The oil and gas industry says seismic testing is thoroughly regulated and involves extensive environmental checks and consultation with locals. Ellen Coulter reports.
John Hammond is a pioneer of Tasmania's scallop industry with more than 50 years' experience. He's had concerns about marine seismic testing by oil and gas companies for about 10 years, since helping a seismic survey team in Bass Strait.
We were going along doing the chase boat work, which is pulling the fishing gear out of the road so the ship could go through, totally unaware of the horrendous damage that this
operation does to our sea life.
Seismic testing involves firing sound waves into the ocean floor to detect the presence of oil or gas reserves.
It's kind of like a giant ultrasound that gives us fairly, well, varying degrees of accurate images of the subsurface so that we can choose potential drilling locations.
David Braguglio is with 3D Oil, a Melbourne-based company that's planning a seismic survey west of King Island between Victoria and Tasmania. 3D Oil is in the environmental planning stage, a process David Braguglio says is lengthy and comprehensive.
And then the government regulator have to approve before we can conduct operations like this, and it includes seismic and drilling of wells, but any sort of operation in the offshore environment.
There's little Australian research around the impact of seismic testing. The oil and gas industry says it's low risk, but the seafood industry and environmentalists have concerns about the impact on scallops, crabs and crayfish. Recent research from the Institute for Marine and Antarctic Studies and Curtin University found noise from seismic air guns significantly increased mortality in scallops. Greens Senator Peter Whish-Wilson is pushing for a Senate inquiry into the impact of seismic testing on the marine environment and fisheries.
And given the fact that the seismic industry is embarking on a whole new set of seismic off the west coast of King Island, and there is concerns in the Tasmanian fishing industry, and I know there's concerns both commercial and brick fishers off, for example, New South Wales with the impact of seismic, it's long overdue to have an inquiry.
A second seismic survey planned for near King Island has recently been knocked back by the federal regulator. The company, Spectrum Geo, told to do more consultation and resubmit its application. Highlighting growing marine health concerns and what they say is inadequate consultation, Seafood Industry Victoria and the Tasmanian Seafood Industry Council have joined forces to develop a mining, gas and petroleum consultation policy. The Tasmanian Seafood Industry Council's Julian Harrington believes the consultation process for marine seismic surveys has become a box-ticking exercise.
We've certainly opened our eyes far wider than we have in the past for the impacts of seismic on seafood in Tasmania, and I suppose in the last 12 months we've noticed that the consultation practices from the gas and oil industry are fairly poor.
But the body that calls itself the voice of Australia's oil and gas industry denies any inquiry into seismic testing is warranted and rejects claims of inadequate consultation. Matthew Doman is with the Australian Petroleum Production and Exploration Association.
The regulator of offshore petroleum activity, NOPSEMA, insists on a very extensive consultation between our industries, and the oil and gas industry is committed to doing that. We value our relationship with the fishing industry.
Regardless of any inquiry, David Braguglio with 3D Oil would like to see more support from the Commonwealth on how to consult with groups opposed to exploration.
As an oil and gas operator, we understand firsthand, particularly in the southeast states of Australia, how significant the gas crisis is going to get. And the reality is that the exploration, particularly for natural gas, actually needs to occur.
Matthew Doman from the Australian Petroleum Production and Exploration Association, ending that report by Ellen Coulter. In the latest move in the US-China trade war, the American government has announced it will spend $12 billion to help farmers cope with huge tariff increases. And it likely will have a flow-on effect for Australian farmers. Nikolai Bauerhartz reports.
The Trump administration has announced the $12 billion fund in response to Chinese tariff increases on crops like soybeans, but also in an effort to shore up support in the US Midwest, where many farmers voted for Donald Trump. Under the new plan, the US government will provide direct financial assistance to farmers, as well as doing things like buying up excess crops and then putting them into low-income food assistance programs. US lobby group, the National Farmers Union, says the government there needs to do more to provide a long-term fix. The NFU's president is Roger Johnson.
Market prices for farm products are plunging from already very low levels, and it's been estimated that farmers lost more than $13 billion last month alone due to these trade disruptions. While we appreciate the move to provide stopgap assistance, this plan is a short-term fix to a long-term problem. The administration must develop a support mechanism that will mitigate the significant damage that is being inflicted upon our most vital international markets for many years to come. They should do this by working with Congress to ensure that Farm Bill programs provide enough assistance to farmers when markets collapse.
So what effect will this latest move have in Australia? Stephen Kirshner is Trade and Investment Director with the United States Study Centre in Sydney. He says it will have an effect, but it's a bit unclear yet how that will play out.
Well, there are two effects there. So on the one hand, Chinese demand is going to be directed to other markets at the expense of the US because Chinese importers won't want to pay the retaliatory tariffs on their imports. And so there may be some scope for Australian producers to pick up some of that demand. On the other hand, of course, you've got American exports that were previously going to China likely being diverted into other markets as well. So it's not clear what the net effect of that is going to be. I think the main implication here, of course, is that just the usual business as usual is going to be disrupted by this. And so Australian producers may find that they're facing new competition in some of their markets.
Stephen Kirshner also says this is a clear indication that Donald Trump is digging in when it comes to imposing tariffs.
This is a classic case of protectionism breeding more protectionism. So you had the US tariffs being imposed on China. China naturally retaliated to those tariffs being imposed, and those tariffs have been very much targeted at the Midwest agricultural states that are politically sensitive for Donald Trump. And so US farmers are hurting from this, and it's no surprise that the administration is trying to support them.
Now, in response already, the National Farmers Union in the US has said that essentially this is welcome, but that it is just a short-term prop-up. Do they have a point with that argument?
Well, I think it's a short-term solution to what's going to be a long-term problem because there's no indication that the tariff war between the United States and the rest of the world is going to get any better. In fact, I think it could get a lot worse. And to the extent that other countries continue to retaliate against US tariffs, then I think US agricultural producers in particular are going to find themselves very exposed and very vulnerable. And I don't think $12 billion will get them very far in an environment where US agricultural exports to the rest of the world are being targeted in this way.
Which is remarkable, isn't it, when you just hear the figure $12 billion and you think that sounds like so much money, but that it might not have that significant an impact.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you look at US exports of soybeans, for example, to the US, that's a $14 billion market. And a lot of the Chinese demand for soybeans is going to be diverted to other countries. So just in that market alone, I think the US is very exposed.
And you've touched on this previously, but what do you think this announcement says about Donald Trump's and the Trump administration's attitude towards tariffs? Is this basically them saying we're digging in?
I think they are. There's a school of thought which says that what Trump is doing is a clever negotiating tactic designed to get other countries to lower their trade barriers. But to get any sort of negotiated outcome here, you have to have some trade talks in progress, and that's simply not happening. The US and China are really not talking at a senior level. The US isn't talking to Canada and Mexico in any meaningful way at this time. And so I think we have to be very pessimistic about where this goes. I don't think we come down from here anytime soon. I think what happens is we have an escalating tariff war between the United States on the one hand, China, the EU, Canada and Mexico on the other.
Stephen Kirshner, Program Director of Trade and Investment with the United States Study Centre at the University of Sydney. Well, meanwhile, in a slightly different take on the trade war, and an interesting example of how agricultural trade barriers are making it into the mainstream, China's state-run and owned overseas broadcaster, CGTN, has produced a video about soybeans, which features a cheery cartoon soybean that talks about the US trade war. But in that video, it does include a not-too-subtle veiled threat.
Hi, everybody. I am a soybean. I may not look like much, but I'm very important. I've been in the news lately because I'm caught in the middle of a trade war involving the two powerful countries of China and the United States. US President Donald Trump has imposed tariffs on billions of dollars worth of Chinese imports. In return, China has done the same, levying taxes on many products from the US, and one of them is, you guessed it, soybeans. You see, China is the world's largest consumer of soybeans. In fact, it imports 85% of the crop. More expensive soy can mean that China will look to other sources for the bulk of its imports. As two of the top soybean suppliers to China, Brazil and Argentina could pick up the slack. If that happens, soybean farmers in the US could take an even greater hit.
That was an animated soybean featured on China's overseas state broadcasting TV channel, ending Nikolai Balhartz's report. Single-use plastic bags have been banned by Australia's major supermarkets. But getting rid of plastic packaging in major food industries like meat and vegetables is not as simple. With the food and grocery industry slow to adapt, innovative farmers and producers are coming up with their own solutions to phase out single-use plastic. I went out to find out more. In this boning room in Melbourne's north, Gippsland beef producer Paul Croc is preparing meat to go out to his customers.
So this is our carcass chiller. So this is where all the bodies come in from the abattoirs. And basically there's no plastic involved at this point.
But after the meat is portioned up, each piece is put into plastic bags. Paul Croc says for the meat industry, plastic is paramount. It's needed for health and hygiene and increases meat's shelf life for up to 8 weeks.
Without putting too fine a point on it, meat uses a lot of plastic. It kind of has to use a lot of plastic. So that's kind of the dilemma that we're in at the moment. But there are people all over the world looking at options.
He's in discussions with European companies who are looking at plastic alternatives and has even floated the idea of casings for meat, similar to what you'd find on the outside of a sausage.
The move for us into minimising plastics is very, very important. We want to be remaining ahead of the curve and look at ways that we can minimise plastic.
But Melbourne butcher Tony Monsanto says there's no simple solution.
Unfortunately, you've got to use some item. You can't exactly have just a flesh of meat and then where they put it, they can't exactly put it in their pockets.
He allows his customers to bring their own containers.
We're happy to pass the meat items into their own containers and then they take them home themselves. So that's probably one way that we've eliminated our part of it.
But in Coles and Woolworths, customers aren't allowed to bring their own containers to the deli. In a statement to AM, Woolworths said the primary issue is food safety and the potential contamination risks of bringing non-sterilised containers into meat, seafood and deli departments. And it's not just on the meat aisles and in the deli that plastic abounds. Fruit and vegetables also rely heavily on plastic packaging.
And that makes the basic frame, which then folds up into the box.
On this strawberry farm in central Victoria, Alan Short has been making punnets out of offcuts from the timber industry.
I mean, it's just, you know, a no-brainer that timber's a better material that's reusable.
So far, he's made over 3,000 punnets. But scaling up an operation like this one for the industry at large will be more difficult.
We're not going to change the industry, but we're going to do our little bit. And again, I can't help but think taking someone else's waste product and turning it into a useful resource isn't a good thing.
Beef producer Paul Croc agrees it will be harder for the whole industry to get on board. But he hopes for now the market will respond.
Farmers can't cop the costs of all of this stuff. We hope that the market will reward us for our environmental efforts on farm.
That was Gippsland beef producer Paul Croc. And you can check out the video of Shorty and his timber offcut punnets on the ABC Rural Facebook page. That's all for Countrywide this week. You can listen back at the ABC Radio page or via the ABC Listen app. For more stories every day of the week about food and farming, you can go to abc.net.au/rural. I'm Jess Davis. Bye for now.